Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I'm sorry for the delay. We had a committee meeting that ran long, and then your board chair had to get his material organized here. So thank you all for your patience, excuse me, and welcome. As has been the custom for a while now, I need to start the meeting with a preamble, and that being, in accordance with state law regarding public meetings held via electronic equipment, this meeting will be recorded and the recording will be posted on the authority's website. Because there's no public comment on today's agenda, members of the public will not be permitted to speak during the meeting with the exception of the authority's consultants and professionals. And also in accordance with Governor Lamont's executive order regarding public meetings held via electronic equipment, board members and consultants and professionals must state their name and title before speaking. Votes must be taken by roll call unless the vote is unanimous. And in the event the meeting is interrupted due to technical difficulties, members and staff will receive an email or text advising whether number one, the meeting is adjourned or canceled, or number two, the time the meeting will resume. So with that as our preamble, first item is doing our roll call. And I will start with Chief of Board Members. Did someone say something? Okay. Roll call of board members. I'm Peter Lisi. I'm present. Mike Angelini?
Present.
Thank you. Steve Elbaum?
Present.
Thank you. Daryl Hill?
Present.
Thank you. Susan Martin?
Present.
And Alan Matamana?
Present.
Thank you. I'm not expecting him, but is Lawrence Davis on the line for the record? No. Kimberly Kennison? No. Or Mark Vahalik? No. Okay. Chief of Staff, excuse me, Jeanette Weldon?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you. Denise Aguilera?
Here.
Dan Junge?
Present.
Bob Jandro?
Present.
Krista Johnson? Krista? No. Dan Kurowski?
Present.
Thank you, Dan. Carly Levin?
Present.
Thank you. Joanne Mackowitz?
Present.
Thank you. Michael Morris?
Present.
Marlene Pagan?
Here.
Cynthia Peoples?
I'm here.
Julia Polano?
Here.
Kara Stewart?
Here.
Betty Sugarman Weintraub?
Present.
Thank you. Vendors and consultants, when I call your company's name, if you are here representing that firm, please identify yourself. Anyone from Acacia Financial?
Josh Nikita.
Thank you. Anyone from Carmody Torrance?
Yep, Ann Zucker's here.
Thank you. Dave Pitney?
Hi, Anita Shaw is here.
Thank you. Hardwick Law Firm?
Debbie Henry, good afternoon.
Thank you.
And Mary Jo Kelly.
Thank you. Hawkins, Delafield & Wood?
Yes, Niles Murphy.
Okay. Hinckley Allen?
Hi, Sasky Clark.
Thank you. McCarter in English.
Hi, it's Jane Warren.
Thank you, Jane. Public Financial Management.
Trina Smith.
Thank you. Pullman and Comley.
Mike Andriana.
Thank you. Robinson and Cole.
It's Sam Reichick is here.
Thank you. Shipman and Goodwin.
Hello, Aaron Levy.
All right. Any other vendors or consultants whose organization I didn't call?
Yes, this is Mike Armstrong. I'm with Hamlin Capital Advisors.
Right, I was gonna get to guests in just a minute.
I beg your pardon.
Thank you. That's fine, no worries. Anyone else from Hamlin?
Yes, this is Joe Brighty from Hamlin Capital Management. Thank you.
Okay, and anyone from One Point?
Yes, Toby Shea from One Point.
Just you, Toby?
Nope.
Ansley
Dave from One Point is on as well.
Thank you, Ansley. Anyone else?
You also have Jackie Shanis from McCarter in English as counsel to Hamlin.
Okay. Anyone else?
You also have Krista Johnson from CHIFA.
Okay, Krista, good to have you.
Thank you.
All right. So with the roll call done and the gubernatorial preamble done, we can go into our agenda. First item being the minutes from April 20th. Is there a motion to accept the minutes as presented?
I'll make a motion.
Thank you, Steve. Is there a second? I will second it. So the motion has been made and seconded to accept the minutes from April 20th as presented. Is there any discussion, any corrections or edits, any comments on the minutes from April 20th? All right, hearing none, all those in favor of accepting the minutes from April 20th as presented, please say aye.
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 Is there anyone opposed? Are there any abstentions? Thank you, motion carries. Next item of business is the hospital sector analysis report. I believe Michael Morris, you're gonna walk us through that.
I am, and I'll try to be quick because it's been a long day already for most of you. All right, next slide, Kara, please. All right, fiscal 2021 results were favorable, both for operating margins and operating cash flow margins. Liquidity was also improved due to the favorable operating cash flow margins, as well as investment returns, improving metrics for days cash on hand and cash to debt medians. Utilization for both inpatient and outpatient volume increased, some reaching close to or near pre-pandemic levels. In Moody's, they still have a negative outlook on the sector, but state that patient volume should continue to improve, but the challenges facing the hospitals include staffing shortages, changes to the payer mix, and the repayment of Medicare advances that were made for relief during the pandemic. All right, next slide, please. All right, a portfolio, we have roughly $2.4 billion of debt. That's about 28% of the total amount of CHIFA debt outstanding. The three largest issuers are Yale, Harvard Healthcare, and Stanford, who account about two-thirds of that $2.4 billion. And you can see pretty much the composition of the hospital portfolio pretty much mirrors that of the overall portfolio as in terms of types of financings. Okay, next slide. Over the past 5 years, we had 13 bond series totaling about $1.3 billion, about 40% new money. For the number of issues, not the dollar amount, but the number of issues, about 30% were private placements versus 70% were unenhanced. And you see the three largest issuers during this time frame for Stanford, Nuvance, and Harvard Healthcare. All right, next slide. For our hospital landscape, for our portfolio, we have 25 hospitals. There's 8 standalone hospitals, which 6 are acute care hospitals and 2 are long-term care acute hospitals. That's Gaylord and Hospital for Special Care. We have 11 hospitals in the 2 in-state healthcare systems for Yale and Hartford. And we have 2 multi-state health systems consisting of Trinity Health and Nuvance. As far as potential mergers and acquisitions, Covenant Health signed an affiliation agreement with the Dade Kimball back in November to acquire that facility. And Yale is looking to acquire Prospect Medical Holdings, which consists of Waterbury Hospital, Manchester Memorial Hospital and Rockville General Hospital. That was signed in February of 2022. And both of these still need regulatory approval before they're formally affiliated. Okay, the next slide, please. Looking at the underlying ratings, we have 3 standalone hospitals with their own rating, along with the 2 in-state hospital systems. And then the 2 multi-state. But one thing I would note, Trinity Health of New England, that's where St. Francis is affiliated with a couple other hospitals. But that rating there That's of the parent, Trinity Health, and not just Trinity Health in New England. They're not separately rated. And in October of 2021, Moody's affirmed Yale's credit rating, but downgraded its outlook to negative. Next slide, please. As I mentioned, there's improvement in operating performance. The operating margin median improved from to 1.7% from the prior year when it was negative 0.2%. Looking at the median revenue growth was 8.8% versus an expense growth median of 4.7%. When you look at hospitals on an individual basis, they did very well, the median of 3.8%, but this doesn't include any of the affiliates, and in particular, any of the physician practices, which typically bring the margins down. Looking at the operating cash flow margin, that increased from the prior year, and it's at the second highest level in the past 5 years, but it's slightly below Moody's overall median of 8.7%. And you can see the range of the operating cash flow margins on the right there, starting with Bristol at minus 2.3%, all the way up to Stanford Hospital at 11.3%. Next slide, please. With these favorable operating cash flow margins contribute to healthy coverages, the median is at its highest level in the past 5 years. We have five institutions that were greater than Moody's A median. All the institutions have positive coverage except for Bristol, and ranging from Bristol all the way up to Hartford Healthcare, a very healthy 15.4 times coverage. But you can see 11 of the 12 institutions there did have favorable coverages above 2.5 times. And as note in the bottom there, there's some over the past year, 5 years, Middlesex and Hartford Healthcare, very favorable debt service coverage ratios, followed by Trinity and New Vance. All right, next slide, please. As I said before, with the healthy operating cash flow margins and favorable investment performance contributed to increased days cash on hand. We have five institutions increase from 2020, and it's at the highest level in the past 5 years. With the overall, the median increased 2.1% from the prior year, and you can see the steady growth in each of the past 5 years. But you can see our median severely, significantly below Moody's overall median. And on the right here, you see the range days cash on hand from 45 days for Bristol to a very healthy 342 days for the hospital for special care. And we only had two institutions that were above Moody's overall median. Looking at, next slide please, looking at the cash to debt. Although the median is significantly lower than Moody's overall median, I would say the sector's not too leveraged. There was a slight decline in the median from the previous year, but that was due to two new money issues, which brought that down. And on the, you can see on the right here, got a wide range of cash to debt ratio, median ratios here from Bristol, about 40%, all the way to Middlesex Hospital, over 500%. And I do believe that the hospital wants to keep that ample cushion and won't be seeking any more debt. Next slide. For utilization on the inpatient side, total patient discharges were up 1.7% from the prior year, but they're about 6% lower than 5 years ago. You see the median, there was a slight decline from the prior year, but it's down about 14% over the past 5 years. For total patient days, increased 4.6% from the prior year, and it's about 3.4% from the 5 years ago. See the median increased 71.1% from the prior year. It's pretty much comparable where it was 5 years ago. So that's pretty much remained pretty steady. Looking at the outpatient utilization on the next slide. Big increase in total ambulatory surgeries at almost 19% from the prior year, but it's about 4% lower than the pre-pandemic level in 2019. Here again, the median is up as well. It's over 22%, but it's down about 7% lower than that three-year average from 2017 to 2019 there. We only had, as far as emergency room visits, that meeting declined for the third straight year. And it's down slightly from the prior year, but it's down over 15% from 5 years ago. And we only had one institution report an increase in ER visits from 5 years ago, and that was Bridgeport Hospital. Total emergency room visits increased 4.6% from 2020, but it's 14% lower than it was 5 years ago. For the next slide, look at capital spending. Total aggregate capital spending for the 12 institutions was about $618 million, but it's down over 26% from 2020 and 19% from 5 years ago. Looking at the capital spending ratio, you see that's declined as well from last year from 1 times to 0.78 times. And it's at its lowest level in the past 5 years. Okay, the next slide. And then we take a look at the capital spending by institutions by the amount of revenues, yearly annual revenues. As you can imagine, the larger institutions have a larger spending on their capital, but on a relative basis, you look at the smaller institutions, that's consists of four institutions like Gaylord, Harvard Hospital for Special Care, Dade Kimball, and Bristol. You look at their median capital spending ratio, and it's higher than that of the five institutions that make up the greater than $500 million in annual revenues. And we've got a wide range of the average age of plant from 7.5 years from Trinity all the way up to 26.1 years for Bristol Hospital. And next slide. Looking at the pension liability, due to the favorable investment returns, total unfunded liability decreased about 60% from last year. And the percent funding status median at 90% is up from 68.5% from the prior year. And you can see the range for the percent funding, which it's not as bad as in previous years, ranging from 67% almost up to 100%. So that's pretty much it. I want to know if there's any questions. And as usual, I'd like to thank Krista Johnson for all her work. Thank you for doing all this for me.
Thank you, Michael. Any questions?
Peter, Mike Angelini, here. No questions, but thanks to Michael and Krista. Really great overview, even for somebody who's in the industry. So thank you for your work.
Thank you, Mike. And actually, I do have a question, and I'm not in the industry. And could we go back to slide number 6, please? That's the one. Just a question, I guess. You know, my reference point is always colleges, universities, or independent schools. And when we look at things like this, like total debt, we might use a divisor of endowment to put it on a enrollment. So we put it on a per student basis. When we look at something like this for hospitals, does it make sense to use a divisor for total debt, like beds or something? Because when I just look at these numbers, absent of the total debt, absent of anything else, it's tough for me to understand the relativity to the overall organization. So this is a long way of asking a question, Mike. Does it make sense to do next to total debt, like debt per bed or something like that, just to put it in have a reference point of the size, given the debt that we're showing there? If I make myself clear.
No, that's a good point. I mean, obviously, looking at both Yale and Harvard Healthcare, obviously, you know, they're going to have a much higher bed complement. But no, I mean, it could put things in perspective as far as.
Is the correct divisor, would it be beds? Is that the metric that a hospital would use?
I'll give you my input. I think it used to be. I don't think it's relevant. More than 50% of our revenue does not come from inpatient beds, and that's just growing every day.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. So it even though, you know, it has the most infrastructure and costs for inpatient, and I think, Mike, you had a slide on discharges and how they've decreased. I think that was in here, right?
Right.
So I'm not sure it really has anything to do with beds. I mean, it is a metric, but I think that's why we don't measure our debt compared to our beds.
Hmm.
You know, can get more revenue on an on a surgical case, perhaps, than a patient who's staying 5 days in a bed.
Yeah, well, that's good to know. Okay.
Thank you. See where you're getting
but
at
we could
first.
Include.
Please, Jeanette, go ahead.
I was just going to say we could include something like debt to total capitalization, you know, that type of ratio in there, Michael.
Oh, yeah, there's plenty of ratios we can give, but. We haven't. No, like Susan's right. I think we did look at that years and years ago as far as.
Everything used to be based on beds. It's pretty meaningless, I feel, at least in our institution. I think it's the same way everywhere.
Yeah. Okay.
You could use inpatient and outpatient contacts, you know, overall volume. That gives you probably a better proxy than beds, but still probably not completely perfect.
Yeah, even that's tough because we've got millions of lab visits. They don't generate any revenue, but we have millions of business. I mean, they don't generate a lot of revenue. I should say it that way.
All right. Well, I don't want to belabor it.
We can research that. I mean,
again, just, you know, for someone that doesn't really know the industry, like Susan or Mike does, just something to show the relativity of these numbers versus the underlying organization. But anyway, we'll move on. Any other questions?
Just one more thing. Maybe it's just as simple as putting another column as everybody's net revenue next to that debt. Is that really what you're trying to get at?
Well, just,
I mean, yeah, that's just in some of those ratios, but.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be helpful. Okay, anything else? All right, Mike, thank you very much. Moving on. Jeanette, Executive Director's Report. Jeanette, you're muted.
Yes, I don't have a lengthy report today, but I did want to mention that last week, the CHESLA board approved the issuance of about $75 million in scarf-back bonds by CHESLA. About, you know, 62 or 3 million of that is refunding, and the rest is new money. And the bonds will be priced and, you know, will be in the market tomorrow pricing the bonds. So just wanted to make mention of that, and that's all I had.
Thank you, Jeanette. Any questions for Jeanette? Okay. Michael, client updates?
Real quick, we have three new issues that were on the report. Two will be presented today. That's University of Harvard and Livewell. The other is Hopkins. That will be presented next month. And we had two closings since last meeting, Sacred Heart University, and then the Frederick Gunn School, formerly known as the Gunnery, closed in April. And we are closing Ridgefield Academy tomorrow. And that's about it.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Joanne, financial report.
All right, good afternoon. For the 9 months ended March 31st of 2022, our operating revenues exceed our expenses by year to date by $2.9 million. And after non-operating expenses, which are predominantly grants of $2 million is a positive change in net position of $875,000. There are no notable items for March.
Okay.
That's it.
Thank you, Joanne. Any questions? Questions? All right. Thank you. Cynthia?
I just wanted to mention in the headlines related to the Federal Reserve, obviously they're continuing to continue the tightening that they want to do until inflation has been tamed, if at all possible, to control the rising prices. They're continuing to increase. So we've had about a 0.75 increase since March from near zero rates for the last 2 years. There's potentially two more 50 basis points hikes in the near future. These, and from what I've been reading, is definitely inflation rates are near 40-year highs. Back in 1994, they were successfully able to curb inflation with about a 6% increase in the Fed rate in about seven hikes. However, I think it's going to be a little bit more challenging this time, even though they were successful back in 1994. Because of some of the more challenging world events that are tagging along for the ride here. So that's all I have.
Okay. Any questions, Cynthia? Hearing none, we can move on to Bob. Market update.
Yes. Okay. Well, unlike last year, right about now, we were still speaking about unabated municipal bond inflows, shrinking new issue concessions, 3% and 4% coupons on new issues, and strong liquidity. Today, the municipal market has done an about face, resulting from the higher rate environment. What we're now experiencing are unabated municipal bond outflows. We're seeing larger new issue concessions, constricting market liquidity, and a return of 5% coupons on new issues. As of last week, it was reported that municipal bond funds experienced their 18th consecutive week of outflows, which have totaled about $54.8 billion year to date. Since the beginning of the year, Treasury rates in the 5, 10, and 30-year parts of the curve are up anywhere between 100 and 150 basis points, with a majority of the impact occurring in the front end of the curve. This has also impacted MMD rates in the same parts of the curve, 5, 10, and 30 years. MMD rates are up anywhere between 182 basis points and 198 basis points since the beginning of the year. 58% of the new issue volume has come in the form of new money, 25% in refundings, and then the balance has been a combination of both. We're still projected to see about $367 billion of new supply this year, which is a 6.4 increase from last year. We're close, as we approach the mid-year point, we're at about $166 billion that's been issued thus far, but we still have about 6 weeks to go until the end of June, and hopefully we'll reach the halfway mark of about $183 billion. And that's it.
Okay. Very nice report. Any questions for Bob? Any questions? All right. Thank you, Bob. All right. We have two preliminary memos that will be presented today. I think we're back to Bob. First one being University of Hartford.
Yes. Peter, it's Steve. I'm going to recuse myself from the University of Hartford and the Village for Families and Children's.
Yep. Thank you, Steve.
As we discuss things.
Yeah.
Okay, the University of Hartford is currently in the process of assessing the economics of potentially offering up to $25.5 million of either a publicly offered or privately placed transaction. They're intending to use the proceeds of the bond offering to finance various construction and renovation projects on the campus, including the renovation of the Village Apartments, which is a 209-unit complex that houses about 900 students. The university has one bond issue outstanding. It's the 2019 Series N, totaling about $131 million. It's rated BBB- with a negative outlook from Standard & Poor's. It's the university's belief that with the issuance of the additional $25.5 million that Standard & Poor's will maintain its current rating and outlook for the university. One area of concern, I guess, when assessing the university's credit profile is the falling undergraduate enrollment, weaker selectivity, and matriculation rates. Weaker matriculation rates. My phone was ringing, so I apologize for that. Much of this was due in part to COVID, as well as just the lack of full-time undergraduate students in the New England market, which the university competes. However, or also I should say that net tuition revenue has declined as a result. It's fallen 3.3% over the past 5 years, as tuition discounting actually increased nearly 25% in the same period. Auxiliary activities have suffered also. They're the second largest contributor to the total overall operating revenues for the university. They have fallen 28.2%. Expense management has been positive. The university had a 2.6 decline in operating expenses over the past 5 years. However, it was not enough to offset the 5.2% decline in total operating revenues. So the university has been experiencing losses over the past 5 fiscal years. However, the university is executing on an ambitious strategic plan to transform the university over the next 5 years and beyond. Coupled with its strategic plan is its financial stability plan that aims at achieving a sustainable budget, but also shares a focus on age of plant and deferred maintenance while improving brand. The strategic plan will be executed in 3 phases, which we've listed in the memo. It also is important to recognize that in addition to the strategic plan and the financial stability plan, the university has already executed or is in the process of executing several other initiatives aimed at improving the university's brand offerings and to boost enrollment and revenues. Some examples of, yes. Did someone say something? anyway, so some examples of some of the initiatives that they've undertaken or in the process of undertaking are the opening of a Center for Student Success, the construction of a new addition to the university's business school, the addition of a new nursing and a doctoral education program, new majors in exercise science and occupational therapy, a new online master's in engineering program, renovations to 2 of the university's largest academic buildings, a plan to transition from Division I to Division III athletics, and finally, the completed construction of a new 60,000 square foot academic building that supports the colleges of education, nursing, engineering, technology, and architecture. It's worth noting that the tuition for athletes at the school or at the university is currently discounted at a rate around 98%. It's expected that as the university transitions from Division I to Division III, that this discount rate for athletes will normalize and become or move closer to what the university's overall discount rate is, which is close to 50%. So hopefully the university will capture significant savings from that alone. So while on the surface, the university does face the challenges of weaker revenues, falling enrollment, it's important to recognize that the university is taking these challenges or obstacles with fierce rigor, with their strategic plan, which they plan to execute over the 5 years, as well as their financial stability plan. And as we've talked about, they've already been executing other changes to their educational offerings, improvements on the university's campus, as well as other offerings to increase the student experience. The renovation of the village apartments, in my opinion, are essential in order to draw the prospective students. The village is the largest residence hall or community on the university's campus. It houses approximately one third of all the residential students. I believe that there's something to be said for having something new and shiny that compares favorably versus what other competing colleges already have to offer. We touched upon this topic last month when we were talking about Sacred Heart. and it was, I think Peter had referred to it as an arms race in previous experiences. But anyways, any college, university, or even an independent school that has the newest and best of everything, be it academic buildings, wellness centers, facilities, student offerings, or even residence halls, is more likely to attract and preserve enrollment than a school that gives the impression of being in lack. From a liquidity standpoint, the university has shown some improvement over the past 5 years, but the metrics still fall short of the Moody's medians. Leverage is definitely on the higher side. Debt service is weak, which may ultimately lead to the need for a funded debt service reserve fund by investors, but still too early to determine whether or not that will even be an issue or not. The outstanding Series N bonds have a springing debt service reserve covenant built within it that will transition most likely into the new proposed financing. If for some reason that the debt service reserve fund were to be required by investors, it's anticipated that amount that it will take out of the financing, it would be about $2.5 million. That $2.5 million would have been able to be used for capital projects. In terms of fundraising, the university is in the process of raising funds to help pay for the cost of the various capital projects, including a portion of the cost to renovate the village apartments. Currently, the university has a goal of $20 million, of which $13 million has been raised thus far. Lastly, as it relates to the financial stability plan, the university anticipates returning to break even or surplus from operations in fiscal 2024. I can open it up to questions.
Very thorough review. Thank you, Bob. Mm-hmm. Any questions?
Your question, Mike, comments?
Go ahead, Mike.
I've got one. Bob, thank you very much for the overview. I just had a quick question. I know, obviously, they're very early or earlier in the process, and I know in your review, comments on whether they're contemplating a private placement or a public issuance. To what degree does Chifa sort of get involved or encourage one way or the other on that discussion? I guess for my own edification.
Yeah. Certainly, I would say that to the extent that a client would like for us to be engaged in that process, we're more than willing to participate. In this case, usually when there's a placement agent or an underwriter involved, they pretty much already know the process, and so the placement agent here has done several transactions. With not only the university, but also with Chifa. So they work hand in hand with the university in this case to, go out, get the RFPs from the banks get the RFPs to the banks, reconcile all that information that comes back, compare it versus, what they're already seeing in the public markets to be able to propose and present the best solution for the school.
Thank you. That makes sense to me. And then just a quick follow-up. Does it seem pretty likely based on market conditions, or is it too early to tell that a debt service coverage fund would be required?
Yeah, I think that right now at this point, that it's more likely that investors will stick with the springing debt service reserve fund, okay, as opposed to demanding one be funded. but it's going to be influenced also by what other transactions that are out there that are similarly rated to the university. And so if you have similar investors in those transactions that are looking at this transaction as well, they may say, hey, we'd like to see a funded debt service reserve fund, but they could also gain confidence in the fact that it already has a springing debt service reserve covenant that right. they could just be like, all right, well, at least the language is pretty much there.
Very good. Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Peter.
Yep.
Yeah. Any other questions? Bob, just one question. Early on in your comments, you said that whether it was a strategic plan or something else, that they're looking to transform the university. So mm-hmm. I guess, you know, transform to what is, I guess, my question. What, I mean, that implies something pretty significant. So what are we transforming to, basically?
Right. You know, Peter, I know that, you know, you certainly have a lot of history with the university and all. And I think that, as you may be aware, you know, the university has been in transition as it is already. I mean, I think that over time that we've kind of seen, prior to, I think, this current administration, if you will, within the university, that I think that things were a little bit more difficult for the school. And I think there was a lot more need and desire, as well as vision, that could have been implemented in the school to kind of get them to where they really need to be in order to compete with some of these other universities that are already allocating funds to improving their universities with new academic buildings and new residence halls and everything else. So I think if anything, the university just wants to get itself to a position where they really feel like, hey, you know, we were here at this level where it was just kind of, you know, getting by, you know, offering, I'm not going to say mediocre, but, you know, just an average type offering from university. And now they're going to hopefully, with all the changes that they've made, with all the new buildings and the addition of new programs, that they're going to elevate themselves to be a better competitor, not only here in Connecticut, but, you know, more in the Northeast. Okay. I think, again, there's okay. a lot to be said to walk on campus and be like, oh, look, new residence halls, look, yep. new academic buildings. It's yep. it's all about the student experience.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Bob, you know, apparently there are no other questions, but in the past or recently, you've had representatives of an organization be available
yep.
for questions. And even though there weren't any today, to the extent that folks can make themselves available next month when the final memo comes to the board, I think that might be a good idea.
Absolutely.
There's a couple people that aren't at the meeting today that may have some questions that folks from the university sure. might be.
Absolutely. I'll have that set up for you.
Thank you. Okay. Next one, prelim memo, LiveWell. Bob?
Yes. Okay. So on LiveWell, LiveWell was formerly known as the Alzheimer's Resource Center of Connecticut. It's in its 30th year of business and has one CHIFA issued bond outstanding, a variable rate private placement that was purchased by KeyBank totaling about $9.3 million. LiveWell intends to issue approximately $84 million to finance the renovation and conversion of its existing skilled nursing units to assisted living units. The reasoning for making such a transition is really based on the current as well as forecasted decline in skilled nursing units compared to the current and forecasted increase in demand for dementia-based assisted living units. Additionally, LiveWell plans to finance the construction of a center for resilient living and plans to refinance its outstanding 2017 Series A bonds. The Series B bonds will be sold as a limited public offering, but to only one investor, Hamlin Capital Management, who Mike will be talking about a little bit later on in our discussion. So the proposed transaction is somewhat of a hybrid to what we normally issue. Typically, our limited public offerings undergo a credit review by staff. They're sold to multiple investors and have a credit rating. In comparison, we have direct purchases, which have no rating, are sold to one investor, and CHIFA places the credit review upon the purchasing bank or entity. The reason this transaction is being proposed as a limited public offering as opposed to a direct purchase is a requirement that Hamlin is imposing to have a CUSIP, which is basically an identifier with the CUSIP Bureau. It identifies the security or this municipal bond as an investment that conforms with the committee and uniform securities identification procedures. It basically helps to improve the securities liquidity in the markets, whether it be in the primary or secondary. The proposed transaction was initially proposed to be issued through the National Finance Authority, with Ziegler acting as the underwriter and Barclays Bank as the purchaser. For reasons staff is unsure of right now, Barclays was actually unable to obtain approval for the financing. And so LiveWell was forced to kind of pivot and seek alternative financing, and is the reason why they're are seeking approval through CHIFA, with Hamlin acting as the purchaser. As part of the previously proposed financing, a draft feasibility study was conducted. And in that study, Dixon Hughes Goodman found that the underlying assumptions were reasonably suited and supported, and that the financial forecasts were sufficient to meet the operating expenses, working capital, financial requirements, and debt service. It's also worth noting that this financing is short in nature, with a 4.5-year bullet maturity. LiveWell plans to seek permanent financing on the near horizon. As I mentioned earlier, LiveWell is an established provider of dementia-related care for 30 years. Looking at their financials, they've been successful in increasing net and total revenues while managing expenses. They've consistently produced surplus from operations and have grown on a percentage basis. Their surplus has grown on a percentage basis very handsomely over the past 5 years. Liquidity is somewhat unfavorable when you compare it versus the medians, but LiveWell has increased their position over the past 5 years, with days cash on hand improving from 139 days to 221. Five-year occupancy averages for both skilled nursing and assisted living have been favorable. We've included in the memo information from the feasibility study detailing characteristics of LiveWell's primary market, as well as competition for your review. What I'd like to do right now is actually turn things over to Mike, have him talk a little bit about Hamlin Capital in the exhibit that was included with the memo. And from there, we can actually have folks from Hamlin either provide remarks and or answer any questions.
Thank you. All right, thanks, Bob. Well, Hamlin's a New York City-based SEC-registered investment advisory firm. They manage approximately $6 billion of assets for institutions and high net worth individuals. They have a minimum $2 million minimum account. They specialize in sourcing, investing in high-yield, non-rated municipal bonds. They clients are either accredited investors or a qualified institutional buyer. And they've been around for 30 years. I don't know. I probably turn it off to over to Joe and explain a little bit about your business model and the reason for the $25,000 denominations.
Sure. Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Joe Brighty, and I'm the partner that runs the bond business at Hamlin Capital Management. As Mike said, we're a $6 billion investment advisor based in New York City. And we have been investing in not-for-profit senior living all the way back to 1987 via the purchase of non-rated high-yield municipal bonds. So this is what we do. This is what we've always done. We're buying these bonds for our clients who, as Mike said, are all accredited and or qualified institutional buyers in a generally hold to maturity, particularly on this short of a structure undertaking. The reason we are coming to you and asking for $25,000 bond denominations within Hamlin is simply we want on a $2 million account, we want to be able to mitigate any idiosyncratic credit risk. And so we really work hard to limit these positions for client accounts from 2 to 2.5% positions. We have worked on this model all over the country with other statewide issuing authorities and have basically put together, number one, a very robust investment letter, which we've shared with Jeanette and the rest of the group that is essentially an amalgamation of concerns we've heard throughout the country. And built that into, I think, a 14 or 15 bullet point investor letter that we sign. And secondly, our investment advisory contract with our clients essentially prohibits the client from taking these bonds should they want to liquidate their account from Hamlin, which allows us to rep and warranty to you that these bonds will stay with accredited and or QIBs. And it's really a risk mitigation structure for us to allow smaller position sizes within our own account base. Any questions on Hamlin? It is, I know, a unique structure, but it's one that we've had for a long time and have worked nationally with large statewide issuers. And the transaction that's being proffered here is very consistent with the ones that we have. We have about 2 billion of these in senior living in the portfolio currently, almost all of which are non-rated.
And you'll be purchasing the whole thing, correct?
Yes, sir. Thank you. We'll be purchasing the whole thing.
Okay. Bob, did you have anything else on that, or should we open up the questions?
Bob,
you're
muted.
I'm sorry about that. We can either turn it over to questions, or if I may, I'd just like to ask Toby Shea, who is from One Point, whether or not he might want to have anything to add or not.
Thanks, Bob. Yeah, I would. I think you covered the summary of LiveWell, accurately and thoroughly. I'd just add that they are what we'd refer to as a regional center of excellence. Just they do an amazing job there. And as Bob had mentioned, despite what you're reading in the industry, they've still been able to maintain very high occupancy, including being at about 100% occupancy today. Which is just I highlight just to prove out that what they do there is sought after by many, and they pull from really across the entire state of Connecticut to serve people with this affliction. The financing that Hamlin has graciously come to the table to provide allows for the organization to continue with this really important project. And it's important not just to get to the end and transition to a different, more sustainable unit mix that gets out ahead of the trends, but to without the financing, the building is getting aged, and they would ultimately have to invest significant dollars just to keep the existing unit mix, which they don't believe is something that should continue into the future. So really it's set up as, a shorter term transaction that's effectively a bridge financing that allows for us to get through construction efficiently, given the structure that that Hamlin has provided, and then be in a stronger position once we're through this credit disruption, and be able to refinance into a longer term financing, out in, in a, less than a handful of years. So really appreciate everybody's and all the hard work that I know Bob and Mike and team put into putting this together on short notice, and appreciate the opportunity to be able to present it to you on behalf of LeBlanc.
Okay. Thank you, Toby.
Thanks. Any questions? Questions? No? Okay. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bob, was there anything else you wanted to add?
No, I would say that just in closing with regards to that is that, again, similar to, direct purchase, private placement that we would typically be presenting this as, I just think that the fact that Hamlin is looking to take down $84 million of this transaction to, break it down and sell it to their clients. I mean, I think that's just a huge undertaking. And I think it's a vote of confidence that number one, they know what they're doing. Number two, that that they have the capability of doing it. And they have the experience. And I just think that it's impressive. And I'm sure that no one would be looking to just go out and spend $84 million and then put it all in their clients' portfolios if they weren't comfortable with the operations at LiveWell.
This is Joe Brighty. Just one thing to add, in addition to putting these in client portfolios, I think this is a really important point. All of the employees and partners at Hamlin will be buying these bonds personally and being in the same position alongside our clients. So we're also voting with our own dollars in addition to our client dollars.
Is that unique to this offering, or is that a policy that you have at the company?
It is a very firm policy and one we insist on for everybody, and we think it aligns interests on all transactions.
Okay, thank you. Okay, anything else on LiveWell for Bob or Toby or Joe? Anything?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, we'll see you folks next month. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Village for Family and Children, Bob?
Okay, I promise this will be a lot shorter.
Okay. Peter, I'm going to have to step out for this one too, as I mentioned.
Understood. Thank you.
Okay, Village for Families and Children would like to request the board's approval today for up to $16 million of tax-exempt bonds to be sold to Salisbury Bank. Proceeds from the sale are intended to finance the purchase and renovation of a three-story building in downtown Hartford that will be used for clinical services. Additional proceeds will also be used to finance the installation of a perimeter fence at the institution's existing campus. And lastly, they're looking to refinance their outstanding 2013 Series C bonds, which were also purchased by Salisbury Bank. The proposed financing has a 20-year term and amortization, a fixed rate of 2.74%. And has your typical security and covenants. Because as a private placement, staff didn't prepare a credit review. So basically I can just open it up to questions if there are any, or ask for the board's approval.
Okay, let's get a motion out on the floor. Is there a motion to accept staff's recommendation on the financing proposal, the memorandum for Village for Family and Children? Is there a motion?
Does Mike Andrew, I need to move?
We have a motion. Is there a second? I'll second it. The motion's been made and seconded to accept staff's recommendation for village village for family and children. Are there any questions for Bob or staff members? Any comments, discussion on the offering memo? You said it is a private placement, correct, Bob? Salisbury Bank?
That is correct, sir. Yes,
credit sir. Review and due diligence resides with them?
Correct.
Yeah. Any questions or comments?
This is another institution that's been around for a very long time. I think they were established in 1809, and they've done very well.
Yeah. Okay. Hearing no questions or discussion, we can take a vote. All those in favor of accepting staff's recommendation, please say aye.
Aye.
Is there anyone opposed? Any abstention? Motion carries. Denise, do the minutes need to show that Steve abstained, or he just doesn't show up in the vote count?
It'll be reflected in the minutes, Peter.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Okay. Michael, would you like to walk us through the memo and this recommendation on the modification of the underwriting guidelines?
Sure. We're looking to amend the guidelines, underwriting guidelines, to allow for unrated public issuance. This is in conjunction with the LiveWell transaction. Our underwriting guidelines were last amended in 2015. Basically to allow BBB- credits to issue $5,000 denominations. This was a change from $100,000 denominations. And it also allowed below investment grade credits with a minimum rating of BB or higher to be issued on a limited public offering basis with $100,000 denoms with an investor later. That has served us well. I made a mistake in the memo. I said there's only two have issued limited public offerings. Actually, we've had three senior living centers and one for Griffin Hospital. But at this time, we think we should further expand our financing options at this time to allow for the unrated public debt offerings as it has become more acceptable in the industry. Obviously, we would still require the debt to be only sold to QIBs and accredited investors and require an investor letter. There is other competition out there, but we don't think that's the sole reason that we should change our policy. That's the two national authorities, one out of Wisconsin called the Public Finance Authority and the National Finance Authority out of New Hampshire. Our role has typically been to protect investors when approving transactions. We still believe we could achieve this goal with proper disclosure and well-structured review and diligence process by all the transaction professionals. We believe that investors and accredited investors in particular are well-positioned to make their own investment decisions, such as Hamlin for the LiveWell transaction. So with that, I'm looking for a motion to permit below investment grade credits or unrated credits to be issued as limited public offerings with a preferred minimum $100,000 denoms on a case-by-case basis. Bonds would only be sold to qualified institutional buyers and or accredited investors and require an investor letter.
Okay. Well, before we get to this discussion, let's get a motion out there. Would someone like to move approval of staff's recommendation to modify our underwriting guidelines? Is there a motion? Anyone?
Mike Angelini, I'll move.
Mike's going to move it. Is there a second?
I'll second that.
All right. Motion is made and seconded. Let's open up for discussion. Are there any questions for Mike on this? It does represent a rather, in my mind, a significant change. The current policy has been in place for a number of years. It seems to have served us well. And as I shared with Jeanette a few days ago, one of my concerns has always been, Chifa's reputation. It's very highly regarded. As we talk about modifying our guidelines, that is a concern of mine. But I would just open up for anyone else to have questions, comments on the motion.
Sure, I have a
and
few.
And Michael, questions. Can you? Sorry.
Go ahead, Jeanette.
I was just going to ask Michael, can you comment on the number of other authorities that are
sure
that have this approach?
Yes. Attached to the memo was a list of some neighboring authorities, Mass Development, Rhode Island. I would say, though, the Dormitory Authority of New York does not allow for limited public offerings for non-rated debt. The rest are, they do allow some, you know, it's on a case-by-case basis. Some have minimum denominations, but overall, looking at all the statewide authorities based on a survey, there's about 13 that do permit unrated public debt. And most of them, like I said, it ranges from, the requirements range from just saying a case-by-case basis. Some say qualified institutional buyers. Some have no special requirements at all. So it does vary. You know, like I said, Mass Development, Rhode Island, Maryland as well, and Vermont. So there, you know, there are authorities out there that do that. I don't know about Josh or Trina had anything else in their experience.
I don't have anything from my end. Covered pretty well.
Michael, this is Josh from Acacia. I would just add that we, you know, a number of clients that we represent, you know, do allow for non-rated transactions, both public issues as well as privately placed transactions. So it is, it is not an uncommon thing in the market from our point of view, and we've seen it, you know, work to a relatively successful degree, and accepted by investors with appropriate disclosures and guidelines in place. It seems to be working well.
Josh, this is Peter Lisi. Is your sense that has evolved over past number of years? And if Chifa were to adopt this, we are just maintaining, you know, being in lockstep with the rest of the industry. I mean, we put these guide rails in place, 6 or 7 years ago, at the time for good reason. And in my mind now, we're taking away the guardrails a little bit. And I'm just wondering, when you say a lot of your clients are doing this, has the market evolved and now we're moving with the marketplace?
I would say it's sort of a mix. There's not a direct answer to that question, Peter. I mean, I would say for a number of our clients, they've allowed for non-rated transactions for a number of years now, you know, going back beyond the last 5 years. Others, I don't know that they've necessarily changed their guidelines. It seems as if maybe the market in terms of investors are more accepting of non-rated credits. Maybe that's why we're seeing more of those in the public markets. So I don't know if it's necessarily issuers changing directly, but maybe more the investors' acceptance of those credits and the credit work that those investors do to create a market for those type of securities.
Okay.
And I was talking to them, just another, you know, note. I know the charter school, market, there's a lot of, that's a common market for there to be non-rated credits sold. So I've seen that's a specific example of credits throughout the country in the charter school space that are non-rated, as an example.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Peter, it's Steve Elbaum. I have a question for Michael.
Please.
A couple of questions. How would this change us or what you and Bob and others do as far as your credit analysis or underwriting of these issuers or of these issues? You know, are there things that you'd have to do differently in your analysis? And, if so, are there, let's say, new or different risks to Chifa because of that?
I would say that for us, I don't think that it necessarily changes our process any. I think given the fact that we are still instituting the fact that these transactions be sold to qualified institutional buyers is you know, important because we want to make sure that we're issuing these bonds such that they're purchased by people that are aware of the risks, that are aware of how to value and determine whether or not an investment is suitable for them or for their clients. So, I mean, to the extent that we continue to do our credit analysis, if it's needed for a transaction, you know, we'll do that. It's not going to really change anything because we're not having to take the steps of going out and determining whether or not a QIB is actually a good QIB or not. That's a totally different thing that we've never really been involved with to begin with. So I think personally that it doesn't really change anything that we're doing. All it does is it opens up for Chifa the ability to do have more flexibility and open ourselves up to providing this service of issuing bonds to more clients potentially.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, the level of review will be the same. I think we can do a pretty thorough level of review as it is for our public offerings. I mean, the level would be the same. It would still be a two-step process for the board to ask questions, preliminary, and then at the final.
Right. And I also think it's kind of an evolution for Chifa, and we are trying to figure out ways to meet our clients' needs, whatever they might be. And some of them might be needs for limited public offerings as opposed to public offerings in $5,000 denominations. And so when you look back historically to where Chifa was, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, when we started out saying everybody had to have a mortgage and everybody had to fund a debt service reserve fund, and we used to specify, you know, exact covenants that had to be included in bond documents, otherwise we wouldn't approve the transaction. So, you know, we have evolved since then, and some of it has been along with the market, but it's also part of trying to meet client needs. And so now, you know, a few years back, we said, okay, we're comfortable without reserve funds. That became, you know, the norm in the market. And so now we're just trying to continue to be able to transition so that we can provide access to capital, but still in a prudent way by making sure it's only going to accredited investors or qualified institutional buyers.
In addition, everything had to have credit enhancement as well back in the day.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Not a bad thing. The other question I have is, you know, how much of the market are we missing? Is there a lot of demand for this, or are we trying to be proactive here?
I would say a little bit of both. We did have a conversation with another underwriter for another senior living facility a couple of months ago, and they would be in the same situation. But I mean, a lot of our clients, you know, can't get an investment grade rating. And some of the smaller ones, especially the ones that, and they're going to be having all their issued private placements that are going to have all their balloon payments coming up in the next 4 or 5 years. If the bank's not going to be willing to be in this market anymore, so we have a bunch of clients. I mean, nothing imminent that we've had, but besides that one other transaction. But I think a little bit to be more proactive as well.
Thank you.
I would add to Peter's comment earlier about, you know, possible concern about tarnishing Chifa's reputation. I don't think that by opening ourselves up to doing this type of financing that it in any way would harm or tarnish Chifa's reputation. I think if anything, it just shows that it actually does more for our reputation, I believe, by opening up ourselves to doing more kinds of financing and being flexible and meeting the needs of current clients and potentially new clients. So
I appreciate you saying that, Bob, and I get it. And very honestly, you know, when I hear Mike Morris and Jeanette talk, you know, put this in a historic context, you know, the way we used to do business. I mean, I was just thinking 5 or 6 or maybe 8 years ago, but to hear the historic trend even longer than that, the things that we used to require that we're doing now, you know, I suppose it's a natural evolution of our business.
Right. I mean, certainly we could be going the other way and say, no way, we're not doing this. We're not flexible. We're not, you know, ever going to do anything like this. I think that's actually would do more harm for our reputation than what we're currently looking at doing now.
Yeah. I very honestly, when it's put in the context of responding to client needs, I think that's kind of, it's an important aspect. You know, we are quasi-public and we should be there to serve public needs. So I guess it's just a natural evolution of the market and of our business.
Right.
This is.
You can probably tell by my comments, I wasn't wild about it initially, but a conversation with Ned earlier, and now this conversation has kind of turned me around. So thank you all.
Peter,
Daryl, did you have a comment, a question?
Mike, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Daryl.
No, I don't have an issue with us providing our financing resources to non-rated entities. I do believe that us doing that, I'm trying not to say burden for the board and the agency, but it, in my mind, will require us to think differently about those entities that are not rated. The brightest example is the answer to the question of why they're not rated. Are they unable to get a rating, or they just don't want to go through the time, effort, and cost of obtaining a rating? So as we evaluate a non-rated potential borrower, the financial analysis that's done internally and along with our financial advisors, I would expect that we will have to hold it to a higher level of scrutiny, because there isn't an independent entity that is saying, oh, they're creditworthy. That's the rating agencies. That's what they do. So to take the rating agencies out of the process, and an entity that, you know, didn't get a triple B or a double B, triple B is where investment grade starts. You know, some folks don't get ratings because they would be below triple B, right? I think that should have our spidey senses tingling, right? About their financial wherewithal for whatever, you know, loan it is that they're seeking. My point being that that work becomes ours, because there's now not an independent entity doing that work.
Well, I would actually say that we are already doing this type of work via, you know, private placement, direct purchases already. We have a number of entities that we've already done deals with that are unrated. And we haven't really ever adjusted anything. And I don't foresee us having to adjust anything going forward just because an entity is unrated.
Well, I think what I would say is I think we are equipped to do the credit review that's required for these transactions. And I think, you know, the evidence of that is the preliminary memo that was done for LiveWell, which was, you know, a pretty extensive preliminary memo. It's not even the final. So I think between that combined with the investor letter, that it sort of completes the process. So from our perspective, I think we'll be doing the credit review consistent with what we have been doing. And, you know, maybe there will be more board discussion. That's certainly a possibility.
And did I hear correctly that for the non-rated financings, the denominations would be $100,000, not $5,000?
So what we're proposing with this guideline change is $100,000 for the limited public offerings. It would be $100,000 denominations. Preferred is how we were going to phrase it. But as you heard from Hamlin in this particular instance. So it's sort of case by case. They're looking for 25 so they can put it in their portfolios of their accredited investor clients.
Yeah, I think that's fine. The 5,000 is so mom and pops can buy in. The larger denominations kind of require what we call them, big boys. No offense in this.
Or girls.
Politically correct. Big people. big people letters, right? The big denominations. Right. Only savvy, sophisticated investors are looking to buy blocks in those denominations. Okay, I'm good. Thanks.
Other questions or comments? Any further discussion? Okay, there's a motion and it's been seconded to accept staff's recommendation on the modification of our underwriting guidelines as presented in the board packet. Further questions or comments? Hearing none, I'll call for a vote. All those in favor of accepting the memo on modification of underwriting guidelines as presented, please say aye.
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 Is there anyone opposed? Are there any abstentions? Thank you very much. The motion carries. Thank you. Okay. Prior to our board meeting, there were two committee meetings, one being audit finance, one being the grant committee. Susan, would you like to give a little recap of the audit finance committee?
Thank you. Better if I unmute myself. So yes, we just met earlier today. Three agenda items. The first item was really an update from management on the implementation on some of the findings or recommendations that were made by Barry Dunn in their engagement as an internal audit function. Most of the time was really spent on looking at an information technology strategic plan, and their management put together a pretty robust plan based on some business objectives and taking the initiatives, again, that were identified mostly through the engagement with Crowe. They were hired to actually look, do a review of the IT systems. There were also some recommendations made by Barry Dunn in previous work that they had done on an internal audit. And a roadmap was laid out. It had about 24 items, some that are already in progress, a few that have been complete. The roadmap goes through 2024 and has those initiatives and the stages that they will be at quarter by quarter. The plan also includes hiring some outside resources where necessary. Those dollars will be included in the budget that will be presented later on this year. And that was really just for information purposes for the committee. And then finally, the committee also reviewed a document put together by management, which included the scope of services that will be included in an RFP for future internal audit services. There was a schedule and that RFP is slated to go out the beginning of June. Management did approve that. So I think we're all on board to get that out as a timeline that was indicated in the memo. And that was the meeting.
Any questions? Questions? It's a great review, Susan. Would you like to also review the grant committee?
No, I would not, but thank you, Peter.
There's an opportunity there. Okay, the other committee meeting was the grant committee. I sat in for Lawrence Davis, committee chair, who was not able to be there today. We had, five agenda items, really aside from the minutes, four business items. And in the spirit of full disclosure, we only got through one of them because we had a very robust discussion. I will say just to back up for a minute, it's certainly been my desire, and I think some other folks' desire, to really have an engaged board discussion or committee discussion with regard to the grants that we award. We have an outstanding internal review committee led by Betty Sugarman Weintraub. But I think there's been a desire to really hear more from the committee in terms of their preferences and desires in terms of what to fund. So in a case of, or an example of be careful what you wish for, we certainly got that robust engagement today at the grant committee. So I think all board members received the package from the grant committee. And what we did was there were three different sections of grant applications. We primarily focused on the highly rated and the middle rated organizations or applications rather. And there was a third category of the lowest rated, and we didn't really focus on those. So the grant committee or the board has slightly over $1 million to award for this cycle of the grants. And we initially approved all the highly rated ones and then focused more on the middle rated applications. And as it turned out, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but we couldn't agree because everyone had different thoughts and opinions. Very honestly, we ran out of time on which ones to fund to get us within the $1,008,000 cap that we have. So there was a motion made and seconded and approved that we essentially sent it back to management staff to take the awards, the highest rated awards in the two categories, and if they were above 75,000, no, to reduce them by a set amount to get us within the $1,008,000 cap. And the management staff is going to come back to us, to the committee, with the list of grants that fulfills, that gets us to that cap of the ones that we've approved. And that would be those would be the awards that were made in this cycle. Jeanette or Betty, did you want to expand on that or the details of what we're going to be reviewing once management and staff provide a new list?
So my the one nuance I think we had in there was that in the middle group, there was a sort of an informal kind of hand vote by committee members to see where there was consensus. Right. And so within the middle group, we're only putting into the fundable bucket, so to speak, is the one that had at least three of the four committee members saying yes, they thought they were that they should be funded. So right. Really, the universe is the most highly rated by the IRC, as well as this other smaller subset of grants. Right. And I think the motion was that was the group that would be approved. And then it was just on management to equitably shave off, you know, give everybody a haircut so that we could be on the program grant so that we could be within the $1,008,000.
That's right. And, yeah, that is an important distinction. Okay. It's just the program grants that are getting reduced.
Right. And my understanding was that management was empowered to then, you know, give that haircut, but we're only applying it to the agreed upon group of grants, and there was no need to come back for another vote. We would report back on to what the results were at you know, subsequently, but we weren't going back for another vote by the grant committee. Is that I don't know what the understanding was, because
correct. That was my understanding as well. And that was grants of 50, program grants of 50,000 or over.
Okay. For some reason, that's fine. I had thought that the final list and award amounts was going to be submitted back to the grant committee, but I'm certainly happy to delegate that to the internal committee and approve it. So, or we did approve it, but now it needs to be approved by the full board, I believe. Doesn't the grant committee's action need to be approved by the full board?
Yes, it does.
That's what I thought. Yeah. So with that as a quick but not necessarily clean review of grant committee's action, are there any questions? Questions or comments? So I would entertain a motion to I would accept entertain a motion to accept the recommendation of the grant committee to approve the grants made for this cycle as presented. Is there a motion?
Sure, Peter. So moved. It's Steve.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Mike Angelini, second.
Are there any further questions or comments? For those of you that were at the grant committee, is there any further explanation that needs to be made, clarification, so that everyone is aware, everyone is clear on what we're doing? Anything? Okay, hearing none, the motion's been made and seconded to accept the grant committee's recommendation. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Anyone opposed? Aye. Great, thank you, motion carries. All right, I think that's the end of our business agenda. Is there any other item of business that anyone would like to bring forward? Anything for the good of the cause?
I have one.
Yes, Daryl.
Move adjournment.
Thank you very much. Is there a second?
I'll second that.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? We're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
And everyone.
Thank you.